Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. Today is our final day of the week for oral argument. It's been a great week of oral argument. We've had 15 cases on the docket, and this morning we'll hear the last four. Judge Jordan and I are really grateful that our colleague from the Northern District of Georgia, Judge Brown, has joined us for today and for Wednesday. We have a custom of inviting district judges from within the circuit after a couple of years on the bench to sit with us and to get an opportunity to work on some oral argument cases and see how we go about our work and when we review their work, and we also get to hear their perspective about how our precedents are working out or maybe not working out on the ground. And we appreciate his willingness to assist us in that work this week and to take on that extra responsibility over and above the work that he already performs for the district court. So thank you, Judge Brown.
Thank you.
Our first case this morning, is United States versus Mosley. Counsel, for all cases, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authorities cited in your briefs. We've looked at least portions of the record. You don't have a lot of time this morning, so in the limited time that is available to you, feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument. You don't need to familiarize us with your case. We know about your case. So let's hit the main points that you want to make this morning. We're probably going to have some questions. If you're answering a question from the court, feel free to finish your answer, but do be mindful of the clock. When the clock expires, it is time to finish up, unless you're answering a question from the court and you haven't finished your answer. And if you do that, you won't lose any rebuttal time if you have any. So our first case, United States versus Mosley. Ms. Howard, will you speak with us?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. There are two issues I'd like to focus on today. First, the district court's failure to give Mr. Mosley an opportunity to object to its ultimate findings of fact, which resulted in reversible error under Jones. And second, the district court's improper consideration of and reliance on Mr. Mosley's bare arrest record. Starting with Jones, after the sentencing hearing, the district court filed a written statement of reasons. And in that document, the district court made four new aggravating factual findings. The district court expressly relied on in its decision to impose a substantial upward variance. The court had not made those findings during the sentencing hearing, and some of those findings conflicted with statements it made during the hearing. Mr. Mosley thus lacked an opportunity to object to the court's ultimate factual findings, which is required under this court's precedent in Jones. And this was not mere technical or harmless Jones error, but instead one that warrants remand because the record is insufficient to review his objections. The record—
Howard, so I get that some of the reasons provided in writing by the district court afterwards were either completely different or slightly different. So one of them was, and I just want to make sure I've got them right, according to your perspective. So number one was, and these are not necessarily in order, but number one is in the statement of reasons, the district court said he had no proof of employment ever. Whereas at the sentencing hearing, the district court had said that he had employment for a brief interlude. So that's one of the ones you contend changed, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, the other one was about the weapon that was possessed having been stolen from the police department itself, right? Because the district court did not mention that at the sentencing hearing, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. The other one is sort of, in my mind, up in the air a little bit. The other one you say was that the other crime was a concealed carry. Is that the third one or fourth one?
No, Your Honor, it's that the third one is that the car was not obtained from legal wages.
Because at the sentencing hearing, the district court said that it didn't know whether or not the car came from legal wages. And here it definitively said that it did not.
Correct, Your Honor. And this, the fourth finding about the firearm that we object to is that it was the type used in local street crime. That was a new finding.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, this is a compact 9mm pistol. You're telling me a district judge can't take judicial notice that that's the kind of weapon that is frequently used in street crime?
Your Honor,
that seems incredibly picky to me.
Well, a couple of points to that, Your Honor. I think the problem with that finding that Mr. Mosley, if he had had an opportunity to object to, would have been the implication that Mr. Mosley had the weapon to participate in street crime.
I don't think that's necessarily the implication at all. I mean, the implication for possessing that kind of weapon is it's just what it says, that the kind that's frequently used in street crime. It might be that he would be likely to use it, but it also, you know, makes it a valuable commodity for street criminals. It's a dangerous kind of weapon to have in the hands of folks with criminal history.
I understand, Your Honor, but I would point out that it's not just that one fact, even if the court disagrees that fact isn't one that the court could take judicial notice of, that he didn't have a chance to object to. It's the cumulative effect of all of the new findings that Mr. Mosley lacked an opportunity to object to that resulted
in. Let's talk about some of them. I mean, the pre-sentence investigation report factual summary was uncontested, and it said that the weapon was stolen out of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. He can make it, he can infer from that it was actually stolen from the Sheriff's Office, right?
No, Your Honor. I disagree with that, and I have a couple of points on that. First, I read the PSR differently. I read the PSR, the only factual allegation about the gun is paragraph 6 in the offense conduct section, which says that the gun was reported stolen in Hillsborough County.
What about paragraph 15?
Paragraph 15 is not part of the offense conduct section. It's applying the offense conduct to the calculation. And it's not making any new factual allegation. I certainly give Your Honor that it's an inartful paraphrase, and it says that it was reported stolen out of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office.
No objection was raised to that.
No, Your Honor, because what that paragraph means is that the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office had reported the gun stolen. If it had meant that the gun had been stolen from the police station, I'm sure that the government would have pointed that out in at some point during the sentencing hearing. It didn't.
But even you're if better, you're, it, seems to, it, it seems to me that your better argument on that point is that if the language in the pre-sentence investigation report was ambiguous and could have been read one or two different ways about where the gun was stolen from, you should have had the opportunity to try to persuade the district court or get probation to clarify that the gun was not stolen from the police department itself.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that was my next point, which is that even if this is a reasonable inference or one of a competing inference from that paragraph, Mr. Mosley was entitled to an opportunity to object after the district court made that inference and made that final fact finding. The government suggests that if something is an inference from the PSR, there's no Jones error. But I disagree with that as a legal premise, because if that's the case, of course, district courts can make inferences. I mean, don't dispute that at all. But if defendants, and for that matter, the government, have to predict any inference from the PSR and preemptively object to those inferences, that would be, for one thing, probably practically impossible. And second of all, it would clog the proceedings with needless objections. Instead, what Jones requires is an opportunity to object after the fact. And if Mr. Mosley had had that opportunity here, he could have presented argument. As Judge Jordan noted, he could have presented, frankly, evidence to show the district court that its conclusion was incorrect. And so that's why the Jones error here is harmful.
Can you turn to the district court's reliance in part on Mr. Mosley's arrest record?
Yes, Your Honor. During the sentencing hearing and again in the statement of reasons, The district court repeatedly emphasized that Mr. Mosley had 59 arrests or law enforcement encounters, what it averaged to be one every 3 months since he was 12. And that calculation included the bare arrest record, which were the arrests in the PSR that had no underlying factual information, but simply the date, charge, and disposition. And this wasn't—
How many of those were there?
There were 15. So it was about half of the arrests that had not resulted in conviction. And when you remove the arrests that were related to the underlying federal charge, it was more than half of them.
By my count, there are at least 48 unique police encounters, and at least 36 of the 48 are not bare arrest unaccompanied by facts. So there are at least 36 encounters that would have been appropriate for the district court to consider, even if this court extended to upward variances the no prior arrest rule that applies to upward departures, which is a separate question. And if you take those 36, we're talking about 12 years. They started in March of 2006, his first juvenile adjudication, and ended in 2018. Dividing those 144 months by 36 encounters, he has an encounter every 4 months instead of every 3 months. I mean, this seems to me to be a meaningless difference.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that. And we certainly do not dispute that Mr. Mosley has a significant criminal record. He has criminal convictions. He admitted to criminal conduct outside of those criminal convictions. And we don't dispute that. But what the district court did here was it took every single arrest. In the district court's calculation, that was 59, not 48. And it equated each of those arrests with a prior incident of criminal conduct. And then it extrapolated from that.
I took out of the calculation some that are really double counting.
There are some that are double counting as well.
That's how I got it, 48.
Correct, Your Honor. But what the district court did was it thought that each one was a prior incident of conduct. And is it okay if I finish my question, Your Honor? I see that.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Okay. You're still on our time.
Thank you. And it relied on that calculation, which was based on its faulty arithmetic and the unreliable bare arrest record, to reach its conclusion that Mr. Mosley had never been free from criminal conduct for any period of time, that his sole product on earth was crime. And those were based on its calculation. And well, it may very well be that the court could come to a similar sentence based on proper considerations. The question here is whether the court relied on the improper considerations in reaching its sentence, and I think it clearly did.
Are there any other questions? Okay. You've saved 5 minutes for rebuttal, Ms. Howard.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Senekin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Sean Siakinen for the United States. I'd like to start by acknowledging the one mistake that was made in this case. It was a minor mistake, and that is that the term of Mr. Mosley's supervised release requiring him to maintain employment was described slightly differently in the written judgment than it was in the at the sentencing hearing. And as this court is aware, when there is a discrepancy between the written judgment and the oral pronouncement controls.
Yeah, so I think we understand that at least is going to have to be correct.
Yes. So that's
I ask you to go to the point about the gun. Are you suggesting that the gun was in fact stolen from the police department, or are you conceding that in fact it was not stolen from the police department?
Neither. The issue on appeal is that if Mr. Mosley thought that statement met what he now
did, anybody is there any reason to think that anybody read paragraph 6 to mean that it was stolen from the police department?
Paragraph 6? No, not necessarily.
I mean, it simply says that it was reported stolen in Hillsborough County.
Yes, in paragraph 15, part of the guidelines calculations to which Mr. Mosley did not object, states that on November 8th, 2017, the firearm was reported.
I understand that, but in the light of the very clear statement in paragraph 6, and knowing that paragraph 15 is a paragraph that is written by a probation officer and seems to use what I think is fairly common law enforcement verbiage of out of, meaning reported by, I have a hard time thinking that anybody involved at that sentencing hearing actually believed there was a claim that it was stolen from the police, such that Mr. Mosley should have in any way anticipated that the judge thought so and should have objected to it.
Well, at a minimum, what the district court said in the statement of reasons was facially consistent with paragraph 15 of the PSR. The district court said the stolen weapon that Mosley possessed was stolen from the police department. That is at a minimum facially consistent with the PSR paragraph 15, which says the firearm was reported stolen out of the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office.
And do you know today whether that was right or wrong?
No, and I that's not in the record. And I agree with Your Honor that it is at a minimum ambiguous, but that's precisely the sort of ambiguity that our sentencing scheme expects and requires defendants to identify when they think it's material or ambiguous and object to when they receive the copy of the pre-sentence report, which Mr. Mosley received in this case.
There's no reason to object, Mr. Seekinen, from my perspective. There's no reason to object if you read that language in both paragraphs as Judge Brown just suggested. It's like, I don't object. Yes, it was stolen in Hillsborough County, and it was reported stolen by that police department. Here's my perspective, and I give you only my personal perspective. I think this is a case that easily calls for an upward variance if I were sitting as the district judge. But it seems to me that the easiest way to take care of everything is just to remand and let the district court decide again whether or not it's going to impose the same level of an upward variance because of at least two things. Number one is the claim that the gun was stolen from the police department. That may have affected the district court's decision about how far to vary. It was important enough to put in the statement of reasons. And Mr. Mosley didn't have an opportunity to argue that, in fact, it wasn't stolen from the police department. Number two, at the sentencing hearing, the district court said that he had a brief interlude of employment. Then in the statement of reasons, he says no employment ever. And then at the sentencing hearing, he says that the Infiniti may have come from illegal sources. In the statement of reasons, he says it definitely comes from illegal sources. Now, all of those things may not make a difference to the district judge on remand, and he may decide to impose the same level of variance that he did before. And frankly, if he did that, from my perspective, I would affirm that upward variance. But
Your Honor,
I don't feel comfortable affirming on this record when some new things were put in the statement of reasons and Mr. Mosley didn't have an opportunity to tell the district court, no, you're mistaken about those three things.
Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that there was nothing new or different in the statement of reasons. And I'd like to address in turn each of the statements that you've mentioned.
Can I ask you to incorporate one other thing when you do that?
Sure.
And that is the fact that the district court here specifically said that he was going to identify his reasons in the statement of reasons. He said, I'm going to give you more information. I'll write it all down in the judgment. And I think that is when you have what Judge Jordan was just talking about, and then he doesn't discuss it at all orally in assessing the 3553 factors. I think that just amplifies the problem.
Yes, there's a lot here. Would you like me to respond to Judge Jordan's question first or to your question first?
I want you to respond to Judge Jordan's question, but in the light of the fact that he never made those observations at sentencing.
Sure. So the first statement is in Section 8 of the Statement of Reasons, it says there was no proof of employment ever. The Statement of Reasons does not say that there was no employment ever. It says there was no proof of employment. There's no daylight between that and the facts in the PSR and what was discussed at the sentencing hearing for the following reasons. Mr. Mosley himself told the probation office that he had never held any job that could be verified other than his uncorroborated assertion of having worked with his grandfather when he was 23. He offered no proof of employment ever, either to the probation office or to the district court at sentencing, and he did not object when the district court stated at sentencing that there was no evidence that he had ever held verifiable employment. So the statement of reasons does not say that as a factual matter, he was never employed. It says there's no proof of employment, which is entirely consistent with the district court statement on page 11 of the sentencing transcript, that with one very brief interlude, there is no evidence of he has no verifiable employment. So that's the distinction.
I think I agree with you. That's your best. That's the best of the facts that have been identified. I think that is a really ticky-tacky kind of distinction. But how about the others?
So the next statement in the Statement of Reasons is that the Infiniti car that he drove came from other sources, not legal wages. And again, there's just no daylight here. Mr. Mosley admitted that the only wages he'd ever earned were $600 per week when he worked for his grandfather for an unspecified period of time at 23 years old, 2 years before he was caught fleeing from police in the Infiniti. So no employment whatsoever in the previous 2 years and only a brief period of employment, earning just a few hundred dollars per week before that. And significantly, Mr. Mosley did not object when the district court stated at sentencing that there was, quote, no indication that he got the car from a lawful job. The car might've been a gift. He might've paid for it with an inheritance, who knows? But the point is that the undisputed facts in the PSR and at sentencing demonstrated that Mosley could not have purchased it with his own legal wages. And that is what the district court said in the statement of reasons. So the third statement is that the stolen weapon that Mosley possessed was stolen from the police department. We've discussed that one. And the final statement was that the weapon—
That's your weakest one, don't you think? I mean, that's where perhaps it's the most material variation.
I don't think that there's a material variation between the PSR, between
Would you admit that it's the closest?
I would say that there's an ambiguity in paragraph 15 of the PSR.
And one that really never came up at the hearing. It just appears for the first time in the statement of reasons, right?
Well, that's right. And this raises another important point, Your Honor.
You know, here isn't the way this is supposed to work is you have a sentencing hearing. And the statement of reasons is just a form.
Exactly.
That a district judge fills out after the fact that we would expect to reflect, be consistent with what has already occurred. And the problem I think my colleagues are having is there it does seem to go further than what comes up at the hearing where the defendant has an opportunity to object to those things. The idea that this was stolen from the sheriff, the defendant says, really just comes out of the blue.
Well, again, I agree there's an ambiguity. I wouldn't say it comes out of the blue because the plain language of the PSR says it was reported stolen out of the Hillsborough County
Sheriff. Yeah, but you could take that more than one way. The district has never said at the hearing, right? That's the way he was inferring that was the inference he was drawing.
That's true, and that's why criminal defendants have capable and qualified counsel as they are required to have under the Sixth Amendment.
I don't think that's a fair response. I have very grave concerns about your office coming here and recommending or representing that this was something that anybody at the time should have had any idea that the district court was going to interpret the language that way. I think it hurts your other arguments because it seems like such an inconsistent reading of the transcript and the PSR, and frankly, just understanding that when somebody like a probation officer writes the language of out of what they mean, it frankly it shocks me that your office is pushing this. And I suspect that if we had you were not at sentencing, is that right?
I was not.
I wonder what we would get if we had the lawyer who was involved at sentencing.
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, and I will stop pushing on this point. Your point is well taken, but I'd like to take a step back then and make an important contextual point. A district court does not find facts in a statement of reasons. Factual determinations must be made at the sentencing hearing. That's Rule 32. The statement of reasons may be submitted up to 30 days after sentencing, getting to Judge Pryor's point. By definition, it contains a brief summary and overview primarily for statistical purposes.
Right, but this was my point earlier, is that he said, it's not like at sentencing, he discussed a lot of it. He went through the PSR and he discussed some of his concerns. But when he got down to applying the 3553 factors, he said, I'm going to vary upward and the basis would be 3553A1, history of the defendant and nature of the offense. And I'll write all this down in the judgment. And then in the judgment, he wrote that what he was referring to essentially was that it was stolen out of or from the police department. It seems to me as though you're right about the purpose of a statement of reasons, but the way he incorporated it into his oral pronouncement seems to me to just exaggerate that he was actually thinking that, but not saying it at sentencing.
Well, I understand that point as well, Your Honor, but I'll say that as I read that portion of the sentencing transcript, I see another ambiguity there. I didn't take that statement in the sentencing transcript to mean that he intended to necessarily, well, first of all, one ambiguity is that those sorts of things typically are not described in the quote unquote judgment, which is what he mentioned at that point. They're typically described in the statement of reasons, which is separate from the judgment. And the significance of that is that this court has held and other courts have held that the statement of reasons is simply an administrative clerical document that does not protect the substantive rights of the individual defendants in the cases in which it is generated.
But you would agree that if a district court gave reasons 1 and 2 for varying either up or down, and then gave reasons 3 through 10 in the statement of reasons for doing the same, a reviewing court and a party would have some concerns, right?
Concerns, yes. I think that's the fundamental question in this case, is whether and how, to what extent, can and should appellate courts review the statement of reasons. And the statement of reasons is not part of the judgment. It's primarily an administrative statistical document. And the few unpublished cases that we found from this circuit addressing these sorts of issues either hold that if there's a discrepancy or conflict, it's immaterial because the document is strictly for statistical purposes, or in at least one case, in an unpublished case, this court did remand for the limited purpose of conforming the written statement of reasons to match the oral pronouncement consistent with
that's kind of at least what we have here though, right?
Well, yes. Yeah, so that would be sort of, my arguments are twofold. One, I do not see much, if any, daylight between any of the statements with which Mr. Mosley takes issue in the statement of reasons and the record at sentencing, but understanding Your Honor's different view that you do see some material daylight, then my point then would be that the remedy for that would simply be remand to conform the statement of reasons to match the oral pronouncement. And
ask him one more question, Chief?
Of course.
If the district court had put all of the things it wrote in the statement of reasons in a memorandum sentencing order that was filed in conjunction with the judgment, would your argument be the same?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. That's a good question. What I would say to that is that this court generally holds that things like the statement of reasons are extrinsic evidence that can be relevant of the district court's intention in imposing a sentence, but those things are only looked at when there is some ambiguity.
My only purpose in asking the question is to suggest that sometimes a statement of reasons really functions like a sentencing order, where the judge sort of sets out in much more detail the reasons why it did a certain thing at sentencing. So that's all. You answered my question. Thank you very much.
I participated in the development of the new statement of reasons form when I was on the sentencing commission. And you're right, it's primarily for some statistical purposes. The sentencing commission particularly wanted more feedback from the statement of reasons where it's easier to capture the data and then manipulate it for, you know, for the generation of our reports, that sort of thing. I'm not using manipulate in the pejorative sense, just an operational sense. But there does appear to be something maybe a little bit more going on. And I think it may well be likely that it goes back to the district judge and he does exactly the same thing in terms of bottom line sentence.
Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I make one very, very brief point?
Yes.
That I have not had a chance to address? It's a legal issue. And that is that whatever this court thinks about the language that the district court used in the statement of reasons, I want to point out that I don't think that this is a Jones issue. And this court has never held, as far as we can find, that Jones requires or guarantees a defendant the right to object to the language that appears in a statement of reasons. And that would be quite a departure and quite a significant extension from Jones. What Jones holds, it's a prophylactic rule that says that the district court must elicit fully articulated objections after the imposition of the sentence. The sentence is imposed at the sentencing hearing. And there's no dispute that the district court elicited objections after imposing the sentence. So whatever issues and concerns this court identifies with the statement of reasons,
Okay.
I think it would be problematic to contextualize that in the Jones framework.
Okay, I understand your point. Ms. Howard, you've saved 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with just briefly the discussion that opposing counsel was having about the point of the statement of reasons. And I certainly don't contest that the statement of reasons is an administrative document that is not intended to make new findings of fact. And perhaps for that reason, that's why Jones hasn't been extended to it. But I think that just highlights the problem of what went wrong here, because the district court did make new findings in the statement of reasons. And what Jones says is not just that a defendant has an opportunity to object after the district court imposes sentence, but that it has an opportunity to object after the district court makes
its. I've got to tell you, I think that the differences here that you've identified are mostly immaterial, but would you agree with me that your best argument about that is the weapon being stolen out of the sheriff's office?
I certainly think that's probably the most aggravating fact and the one that is the most.
There's the clearest difference too.
The clearest difference. Yes, Your Honor. And I did want to just respond. There was a question about, you know, whether the gun had actually been stolen out of a sheriff's department. And I agree, it's not in the record. But I have reviewed, could make a proffer that I've reviewed the discovery we received. And if Mr. Mosley was able to go back on remand, he would be able to, I believe, show that the gun had not been stolen from a police department. And if the court would like me to supplement the record on that, I'd be happy to.
No, I'd rather not do that.
Okay.
I didn't ask the question.
I'll trust you on that.
I didn't ask the question to suggest that it actually matters. Obviously, we have a record in front of us. It's just the fact that there seems to be an argument being made that is at odds directly with at least one statement in the PSR. And I think a fair reading of the second statement when you consider that it's written by law enforcement.
I absolutely agree with that, Your Honor.
And I think the point you're making about the statement of reasons is that the only purpose it has here is to identify a factual finding by a judge that was not enunciated at the time of the sentencing and therefore not objected to. Is that your point?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And so Mr. Mosley did not have that opportunity to object. And had he had that opportunity to object, he could have put on his argument, he could have put on evidence to show the district court why its factual findings, its new factual findings, were erroneous. And had it done so, the district court may very well have made different factual findings, which may have impacted its decision on this sentence, or at the very least, then this court would have a more developed record to review Mr. Mosley's claim on appeal of the procedural error that occurred. But that didn't happen here. And so to Judge Jordan's point earlier, I think that the easiest thing and the best thing for this court to do is to remand so that the district court can have the benefit of Mr. Mosley's objections, it can have the benefit of his arguments and evidence, and it can decide in the first instance what a reasonable sentence is based on the correct information and then the reliable information about Mr. Mosley and his offense. If there are no further questions.
I don't hear any, Ms. Howard, and we appreciate you giving us some time back. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, have a good weekend.